session number 28358, reel 8.
Mrs. Jill McNair, reel 8.
One point I should have mentioned, when we arrived, we were told we were part of the occupation force of Japan, and we wore badges on our battle dress on our arms, of shoulder flash. But after we had been there just over a month, I think Japan reverted to its national status. It was given back to the Japanese, and we were no longer occupation forces, and we became part of the British Commonwealth Force, part of the brigade out there. And that would have been about April, I think, 1952. Something
yes,
like
that would have been after their their treaty with the United States,
yes,
wouldn't it, when the occupation.
And I think the
finished.
Main reason was the Korean War, because the Americans wanted a base in Japan to fight the Korean War, and they reverted more quickly than they would have done. I've heard about this later.
Yes.
I believe that was the real reason. Mm. But
did you get a feeling at that time, you know, the Korean War was a dreadful thing.
Yes.
But that perhaps Japan was sort of benefiting from
Oh, yes. Benefited. It completely benefited from it, financially in every way. Because eventually, when I was in Kyrie in 1953, I was invited to go to the launching of the first Japanese tanker that had been built in Kyrie Dockyard, and this at the time was the largest tanker in the world to be built. It was huge, and this was launched by a Japanese princess, and it was called Petra Kyrie, and there were many, many VIPs there, and we sang so many national anthems of various countries. It took a long time. It was very cool, but I was very privileged to go to that. So Japan was beginning to get back on its industrial feet, and I was there.
And I suppose a lot of the troops in Korea, they had their leave in Japan.
Yes, they did. They tended to go to Tokyo, I think, most of them, if they could, obviously. And also, where we were, there were various basic training army camps, and they would either come out from England to Korea and do a training there before they went over to Korea. I think they were warfare schools. I can't remember what they were called now. Or they would come back from Korea and perhaps go and do a course, possibly go back. And I think some of them did go from Korea to Korea for their R&R if they wanted to. Because they would have had R&R leave from Korea.
Were they ever involved in any direct way with the war, the Japanese? I know they wouldn't have sent troops because of their status at the time. But do you know if they sort of helped with war materials? And
I don't know, but I did see a documentary years ago. It was fascinating how Japan benefited from the war, and I think probably there must have been things that the Americans asked them to produce, and bases. And you see, we employed over, I think there were 1,300 Japanese, so well over 1,000 in one hospital, you see. So it would have given them employment and things. And the very fact that Hiroshima had been rebuilt with big department stores by then, it was
very quick revival, wasn't it?
Well, it was, yes.
Probably quicker than London in some
Yes, way. Yes, I'm sure, because I'm sure when I left London there was still damage around.
How well trained do you think you were, Jill, for the type of wounds and diseases you were coping with, the illnesses? You know, this is just Japan at the moment.
Yes,
we
yes, yes. I think my basic... I had a very good training, particularly at the Radcliffe, particularly in surgical nursing. I didn't have any special training for gunshot wounds or burns, because at that time the treatment of burns was very mixed and very difficult. It never occurred to me that I should have had any special training. I think doing the course in tropical nursing had been beneficial because of living in Japan. Although we didn't have cases of malaria because we all had to take our anti-malarial pills and things like that. But with one or two things, I'm sure that must have helped tremendously. One really didn't have time to think about that. You just had to do your best, and techniques have changed so much since. But no, I don't think we had any special training. Our discipline was very tough, and that was probably a good thing.
So I suppose you learned about gunshot wounds on the job,
didn't Yes. you? One patient I've just remembered about, and he was a very brave lad. He was a young officer, but it didn't matter what rank they were, they were all the same, but this one had really been plastered, literally, because he was in the plaster of Paris in a case right up to his neck. I think his arms were in plaster and one of his legs. And I took 70 stitches out of his face. Alone, 70, over 70, 770 out of his face alone. And he was still laughing at the end of it. And he was probably 1920 something like that. A lot of them were National Servicemen. So, and there were many, I mean, many of the boys, it didn't matter who they were all the same. The gunshot wounds were much the same. They were either sort of suppurating wounds or they fractured the bones. There were fractures in, and sometimes they were in plasters with stitches. And many lost limbs. And there was another case I remember on this ward again of an Australian officer, a young man who just had promotion to major. He was very young too. And for some reason, he was being in a jeep or something, he'd lost the circulation in his leg. And he was going to face an amputation when I left the ward. And, you know, there were so many cases like that sometimes after you'd done a long stint of duty and you really could do with some leave, you did feel a bit down about it. But I find it rather difficult to describe because they're mostly surgical wounds or, you know. But then we did have this medical ward with about 30 beds and they're mostly full of infective hepatitis. And they were very sick, and they had to be on a very bland diet, and no alcohol or anything like that. So this went on for some time. And then we had this isolation ward, which I was in charge of for some time, and we had various cases from meningitis to several long-standing cases of very poorly tubercular patients who were very, very ill, and we had to get there. Wait out before they could ever attempt to go home by hospital ship. I managed to do it, but it was very, very, they were very poor. Some of those were non-combatants. They belonged to the NAFI. I remember one or two NAFI men were patients in this particular ward. They were in separate rooms.
And would that be from the poor conditions they were?
I think it must have been, yes. I mean, the diet was not marvellous where we were. We had Australian rations and they were okay, but the food wasn't terribly good. It was all right. I mean, it's nothing sort of. But occasionally, we were lucky. There was a naval ship that would come in, HMS Unicorn, and some of us knew people on board there. And she was full of explosives, which she didn't know at the time. She was all anchored out in the harbour. And we used to go on board for dinner or something, or go to the cinema on board. And they would always have lovely fresh lettuce and things which we hadn't seen for years, and you know, and we were sport like that, so it was nice. But we weren't allowed to go out to any Japanese restaurants. You see, we couldn't do anything like that. We weren't allowed to do it. And
was it
at
sort
that
of
time,
a non-fraternization rule?
I think so. And when I was leaving Japan in 1952, and the war was over. The rules were being relaxed, and they were being the QAs, I think, were allowed to go out in dresses, mufti. But it didn't really affect me because I left before this happened. Yes, I think it was the fraternization thing, probably. And, you know, you weren't, I think, you had to get permission if you did go to a restaurant, because once I did go to one, we were asked, I belonged to the Screen Room Club, and we were asked to, we'd put on several plays, and we were asked to put on a play by the American Cultural Society for the Japanese in a hall in Hiroshima. We'd just done a play by Agatha Christie, and one of the main parts, a chapter in main part, had been posted. This always happened in the army, or left or was ill or something. So we couldn't do that, and we had to rake something up. So there were only a handful of us, and we decided to do parts of Shakespeare, which we'd read to them, and something else. I can't remember how we did it, I don't know, but we, there were five of us or something. We drove over to Hiroshima and gave this, and I took Portia's part and something, and you know, and we read these things to a hall full of Japanese people, and one chap sort of bolted in front of me, and I got the giggles. Anyway, that was all part of it. They seemed to think it was all right, and afterwards we thought it was late, we'd go and have a meal in a restaurant, which we did, and I probably shouldn't have done it. And also, I was the only female officer in a mixed group, and I knew I shouldn't have been there either. I was always in trouble. And anyway, we had this meal, and I'm sure I was posted to Korea soon afterwards. I'm never sure whether it's because somebody dobbed on me or whether it was it had come up. But anyway, that's another story. But
what was this Green Room Club?
Well, it was a club in I should have mentioned, I'm sorry, in Curie. There's a large, quite a nice building at the bottom of the hill, about a mile from the hospital, called Curie House. And this was a sort of comfort building for the troops. And there were shops there, a sort of naffy shop and things. And they had a club there. They could go there to have meals, rather like our club further up the hill, where you could have a cup of tea or meal or something. And there was a hall there, and they had dances, all ranks dances, which we had to go to, so we could dance with them, because the poor lads had nobody. I'm not that they particularly wanted to dance with this, but they had nobody, you know, the Red Cross used to organise these. And they had this Green Room Club, which was an amateur dramatic society, which I was asked to join. And we put on several plays. The most successful was the Dark. Well, there were three short one-act plays, and one I was in, one of them was The Dark Lady of the Sonnets. And this was just before Christmas 1952, and I took part of Queen Elizabeth. I made all the costumes, we made all the costumes by hand. I pinched plaster muslin to make the ruffs, etc. And we put it on, of course I was put on night duty at the time, so I had to get somebody to relieve me. And we had a VIP audience, a real top brass, and people that were invited to see this. Put it on several nights, and a couple of nights or something. And it was meant to be a comedy. But I think because people were so homesick, they took it more as a tragedy. And there was a terrible hush after we finished. And then the applause is immense. And I think it was so English, you know, this play. And I mean, we had some top brass admirals and people in the front, but it was amazing. And I took part in several things like that. I did that even when I was running the hospital train or on night duty. I mean, this is what I meant. You worked hard and you played hard. It was all part of the life. You were young, as they say.
Well, I think the hospital train now, because
yes.
I believe this was, you were on a couple, weren't you, of missions?
Yes, I was. That's
so this
right.
was the first one in Japan?
Yes,
is it
was.
Right?
This was in March 1953. The war was still going on, and the peace talks were going on and not getting anywhere. It was very sad because we were still getting a lot of wounded in and sick from Korea. And had this leave in Nikko and Tokyo, got back, read my orders, and I was sure I was going to go on night duty. And to my surprise, I had been allocated to take charge of the small hospital train that ran between Curie and Iwakuni, which is beyond Hiroshima, where the Australian Transit Hospital was, which catered for the wounded that was airport flown over from Korea. And they were collected by train and taken back to Curie. I was thrilled to bits because, being a Commonwealth hospital, the sisters in charge of the train, the duties only came round very rarely. You did a month on, and it was shared between the Canadians, the Australians, and I was quite young and junior to do it, and I was absolutely thrilled to be given charge of this. The train consisted actually of one large hospital coach, but if you had a lot of wounded to collect, another one would be hitched onto it, and this would be hitched onto a train which would take you, an ordinary train, take you from Koori through to Irukuni. Irukuni was about, I should think, 20 miles from Hiroshima. And my day on the hospital train started. I was in charge. I had to be very responsible, and especially with my self-discipline, because I had to get myself up at 5 in the morning, swallow some breakfast if I could find some, and then go to the hospital, collect, they were called medical evacuation. If you had patients to take over to the airport who were going to be medically evacuated home to their countries of origin, the ones who were convalescent, you would collect them, could have sort of a dozen, 20, something like that, from the hospital wards. You'd have a fleet of ambulances, and I had, occasionally I had one Australian female nurse to help, or an orderly, or sometimes I was on my own. The ambulances were organised. You'd collect the patient's notes, their x-rays, their belongings, get them safely into the ambulances from the hospital, and then drive down the hill right the way along to the station. There you'd disembark them. The RTO would meet you, the train would be in. The train I would have prepared the day before itself with, I'll explain in a moment, and then you'd settle your patients on the train. Or perhaps I better explain the train now. You walked into the middle of it through a double door, and there's a sort of area where the walking wounded could sit. And then turning to the right, you went into literally a mini ward, a small ward, with, we called them litters. They were bunks, double bunks on either side. And I think I could take, I think it was 16 litters. I had 16 litters, something like that. And then beyond that, there was a small, I think there was a lavatory and possibly a shower room for the patients at that end. Then if you came back through this ward, through the open area where you would put chairs for the walking wounded, there were cupboards of chairs, and there was a narrow corridor with two small rooms on the right. The first one was my office. No, sorry, it was the treatment room. And in that I had a couch, I had the drug cupboard, I had a small electric sterilizer to boil instruments and syringes. I had all the facilities for doing dressings, giving medicines, looking after patients, doing anything special for them, redoing their bandages, etc. there. And that was called the treatment room. And I had a locked drug cupboard and a medicine cupboard there. And then there was a tiny compartment beyond that with a small railway carriage seat in, which was my office, and a small sort of desktop. And I wrote my notes there, kept the patient's note there, kept my belongings there. And beyond that, at the end of that coach, was a kitchen. And there was a big brown teapot, mugs, kettle, a sink, and water for making tea, sandwiches, or whatever. And that was the one, all in the one coach. And so I'd get the patients down there, settle the stretcher patients in. I had stretcher bearers with me into their bunks. The train I would have prepared the day before and made up all the bunks with clean sheets, blankets, checked all the food, took milk, bread, stuff for sandwiches, all the dressings, the dressing drum, the syringes, medicines, everything was in place, everything clean. And the then, sorry, I'd get the patients on, and then if I had any walking wounded, they would settle in the sort of atrium place, or they could, if they weren't ever patients on the bunks, they could sit on the bunks.
Would you have had others to help you do all this?
I would have had one nurse, probably. But there were one or two occasions that I didn't. I did it on my own, probably only going to collect wounded. But, you know, yeah, there was only one. And then we would... the train would be... The coach was already hitched to a local train, and we would steam off. It was full of smuts and things. In those days, coal-burning trains in Japan. And we'd steam along the inland sea. It's beautiful scenery, overlooking the river. Hills on one side of the sea and the terrace crops and things. Amongst our treasured possessions, we had a wind-up gramophone with records, which we used to play to the troops when they wanted to relax, and La Mer was a favourite, or favourite of mine. But I would make sandwiches and tea for them, whatever they wanted, the patients, and check their wounds and check they weren't bleeding or the plasters were comfortable and that. And then we would get to Hiroshima. And the very first trip I did, I arrived at the station, you wouldn't believe this, with a feeling, you know, quite sort of apprehensive about it, because there's a lot of responsibility. And I think I had 29 patients and one Australian nurse. And the RTO said to me, "It's no good, sister, you can't take all these patients, you haven't got room on that coach." I said, "Well, what about the other coach house problems?" "Oh, well, it's not here, take too long, the train's going very soon." And I had a bit of a row with him. He said, "I'll send the walking Australian," I think I had 9 Australians, "with the Australian nurse up on another train." I said, "I can't do that." But anyway, he said, "We'll have to," and I had to decide whether to go ahead with this or whether to ring Matron on my very first day and tell her I'd failed already. So I decided I'd take potluck and go ahead. And I went on with my wounded and my stretchers on the first train. And we linked up, I think, at Hiroshima. We locked, hitched together there. But that was an awful worry, the very first day. Anyway, from Hiroshima, sometimes we were... And it was very gloomy, Hiroshima Station. It was awful, dark and horrid. And you were shoved in a siding in a tunnel. Then you came out and hit something else. Not always, but most of the time. And then you went along the rest of the inland sea to Urukuni, which was on the inland sea. And it was the airport where, airstrip or whatever you like to call it, where the planes took off for Korea and came back from Korea, or for Australia or various places. And it was run by the Royal Australian Air Force. And there I would, when I got there, I'd have to transfer all the patients to waiting fleet of ambulances again. Myself, I was responsible and had to carry the drug box, the notes, the x-rays, and I could never leave the drug box out of my hand because I had morphine and things like that. And then we jogged along through Iwakuni, through the winding streets, which was quite a long way, and suddenly you arrive at this huge red brick building, which was taken over as the Australian hospital. And there I used to transport my patients safely to the transit ward, and then the Australian sisters would take over. And if I had a nurse with me, we would be given a meal behind a screen, have something to eat, because it got up pretty early then, you see. And then if we had patients to collect from Korea, we would wait for them and then take them back in the ambulances to the train and transport them back to Curie, then the ambulances again, and then back to the hospital and see them safely there. But if we didn't, we left the train where it was, and we would come back by work boat across the inland sea for 2 hours, which was lovely, actually, and very nice. And then, I don't know, we somehow got a jeep back to the hospital or something. Then I'd have to give my report and hand over. And I did this for a whole month. I didn't do... that we didn't have we called them convoys in every day. And on the days I wasn't working on the train or getting the train prepared, I had to work as a relief sister on the wards. And that's how it worked. But they were long days. And then I was due to come off the train, which was rather sad because I loved it. Oh, incidentally, I wore my khaki battle dress all the time on the train. You couldn't wear indoor uniform. And you wore khaki slacks because we were in and out of high trucks and things. It was easier managing like that. Just before I was due to come off, Matron sent for me and she said, "We're keeping you on the train hall because of your experience, because we've had some very good news. The first British prisoners of war are being released early by the communists and we would like you to be the part of the team to collect them. The North Koreans or Chinese communists, I'm not sure who they were, released 30 British POWs. They released a handful of them in the April before the war ended, and I can't remember the reason why. And this was called Little Switch. So I was thrilled about this, and I spent a day polishing the train, getting everything ready.